In 1962, an American physicist named Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's often listed as one of the most influential books of the 20th century. Indeed, Kuhn's book set off a bombshell. He challenged the entrenched philosophical assumptions of how science worked. And if you think it's over your head to think about Thomas Kuhn this morning, if you've ever used or heard the phrase paradigm shift, it's he who coined that phrase, and he's had an influence on your life, whether you've liked it or not, if you've used that phrase. With the tip of the hat in the book's introduction to his personal interactions with a Hungarian thinker named Michael Polanyi, Kuhn argues that the history of science is not at all a history of scientific discoveries simply advancing on the back of previous scientific understandings with absolute certainty. A traditional view of science, I suppose, holds up science as the only sure thing, the only thing that's certain and verifiable, that kind of never goes out of date, and that all the current scientific certainty is an advancement of past scientific certainty. But Kuhn's point as a physicist is that's not the history of science at all. He says that when you look at the history of science, you don't see progress based on past certainty, but you actually see scientific revolutions in which former models of scientific thinking aren't adapted, but they're actually discarded altogether. In other words, take a given scientific paradigm, which today sounds wise and certain that one puts his or her faith in. Eventually, it won't be able to keep up with an emerging array of questions. And the result is that a current paradigm is stretched to its limits, sending the whole paradigm into crisis, which eventually results in a total new way, a paradigm shift of thinking about things. Thomas Kuhn says that is the history of science, a history of scientific revolutions. So think about some examples of kind of scientific certainty giving way. In the 1500s, the scientific world was changed radically with the Copernican Revolution. Then from around the Middle Ages to somewhere around the 1800s, the dominant theory of how people got sick, or one of them, was something called the miasmus theory. And so for centuries, the scientific community was confident that diseases were spread through poisonous vapors of the air, which might be true if you have small children, but is not very scientific. So the explanation for sickness, I remember taking a carriage ride in Charleston, South Carolina, that they thought in the early settling of South Carolina that people were getting sick from the foul air in the swamplands and the marshes, so they called it malaria, bad, foul air. But today, that theory that was touted as absolute certain is given way to totally different understanding. And then in 1900, Lord Kelvin stands up. There's nothing new to be discovered in physics now. And just 5 years later, Albert Einstein published a paper on special relativity that changed the way physics is done. Now, those are just three examples: a Copernican revolution, a revolution of disease theory, and the revolution of physics. But they demonstrate, I suspect, that the one thing science can actually tell us is that what you know now will probably change drastically. Ironically, the one thing science can be certain of at some level is uncertainty. The theory that you're putting your faith in now will probably be out of date. And so the history of science is a history of Titanic-like boasts of unsinkable certainty followed by Titanic shifts in thinking. Now, you didn't come here this morning to hear a scientific lecture. I'm not the one to give that, and maybe I didn't summarize Kuhn's thought exactly correct. But here's kind of the point for those of us who put our faith in science. In the West, we boast in the wisdom of science. And at some level, maybe that's you this morning. Your faith is in what you can see, what can be proved under a microscope. But science can't possibly answer all of your questions, can it? And even the answers that science gives now are not the best ones. They may not be. And therefore, true wisdom demands humility. It's a mark of a wise person to be humble. Sooner or later, your wisdom will run out. And you'll have to humble yourself before a wisdom wiser than your own. Will you be a wise person and humble yourself? That's what the Christian Bible warns us of. Do not lean on your own understanding. Do you know why? Because human understanding is limited, and it doesn't always give. It regularly gives inaccurate readings. And so, in the story of the Bible, here's the understanding that something called sin enters into the world, and it sets us against God. It sets us against ourselves. It sets us against one another. And it makes it impossible to pursue pure reason. And so I think at one level, Kuhn's work tells us exactly what the Bible tells us, that human wisdom is limited and flawed, and therefore you must be ready to humble yourself. You cannot think your way out of life's most important questions. You will have to humble yourself. And this has everything to do with our text this morning. And the biblical account where we'll look at, we're seeing the pursuit of wisdom, wisdom and folly contrasted. The story shows us a war between a historical figure, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, against the wisdom of God. And it's a tale of two wisdoms, a wisdom that rages today. We're confronted with God's wisdom and our own. If you're not there already, would you locate Daniel chapter 2? Daniel 2. This is a book in the first half of the Christian Bible. Daniel is the main human character, and it's named after a Jewish teenager who's taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And it's a time of darkness. As the God of Israel looks dead and the holy city of Jerusalem is reduced to nothing more than an archaeological dig site. And Daniel, along with several of the best and brightest of the Jewish youth, will endure 3 years of a kind of forced social reprogramming. And the book of Daniel is asking, how can Christians live in a secular world where God looks like he's dead? When we come to chapter 2, the wisdom of two worldviews collides. I think what we'll see is that one source of wisdom leads to pride and unrest and the abuse of power. The other source of wisdom leads to humility, rest, and the appropriate use of power for others. Those are things we're all interested in. How do we use wisdom? What's the best use of power? The question leads us to humility and rest and the use of power for others. Where does that wisdom come from? We're going to read large portions of this in just a moment, but I want us just to note the organization of the next several chapters of Daniel. They're laid out in such a way so that we see the inevitable collision between the wisdom of God and the wisdom of Babylon. First, if you're not aware, the entire Old Testament, the first half of the Christian Bible, is written in a language called Hebrew. But there are some places in which it's written in another language called Aramaic. And why is that important? Well, in the ancient Near East, Aramaic functioned like Greek would have functioned under Alexander the Great and the empire to follow. Or it functions like English does today. That is, Aramaic, like English, is the international language of business. It's the international language of politics. It's what you write your journal articles in and you come together and have your debates in. It's the international language of the day. Well, guess what section of the Bible contains the largest section written in this international language called Aramaic? It's Daniel chapter 2 all the way through Daniel 7. Now, why do I note that? To kind of impress us with a bit of biblical trivia? No, because to impress upon us that Daniel 2 through 7 is an undeniable confrontation, an undeniable engagement with the wisdom and culture of the world. He uses the international language. He's kind of calling, you know, he's calling a parley in the code of the pirate. He's calling, come now, let us reason together. He's engaging the wisdom of the world. Let's sit down and interact. Examine the wisdom of your life. Examine the wisdom of Babylon, symbolizing the world. And you must come to see, you must put your trust in the Most High God alone. The second thing to note of the organization of chapters 2 to 7, they're not only written in a way to dialogue and engage the wisdom of the world, but they're organized in kind of a ring cycle. They mirror and parallel each other. so chapter 2 is all about this colossal vision. Well, that's mirrored all the way in chapter 7, which says the same thing with a different vision. Then you move from 2 to 3, and it's all about persecution in a fiery furnace, which arcs all the way to chapter 6, which is about persecution in a lion's den. Both accounts show us how fierce the conflict is between the wisdom of God and the wisdom of Babylon. They show us the need for commitment to a faithful God. And then, right in the middle of this section, right at the heart of this kind of tract to the world, are chapters 4 and 5. And in those two chapters involve the humbling of two public national figures, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and Belshazzar and the empires to follow. So they're arranged in a way that they mirror each other. They kind of ring and come back around to each other. And they're telling us then two things. They're telling us, here are the kinds of things you can expect as you live life in a secular environment. And they're telling us, they're making this assertion that an all-wise, all-powerful God demands that you humble yourself before Him, the only wise God. So what we have in front of us is an argument, an apologetic, reasoned argument through language and stories, confronting the wisdom of the world over and against the wisdom of God. So we'll see this happen as we read a large part of this first account. We'll read the first 30 verses and then skip a little to the end. Let's get into the story where we see wisdom in collision here for us. This is what Holy Scripture says. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell the servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. The king answered to the Chaldeans, The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretations, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream first, and then its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and then we will show its interpretation. The king answered back, I know with certainty that you're trying to gain time, because you see the word from me is firm. If you don't make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation too. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them as well. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to the captain, Why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went back to his house, and he made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and he told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed, along with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered, he prayed, and he said, Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belongs wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Then in verse 26, Daniel goes into the king, and the king asks him, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen in its interpretation? And Daniel answered and the king, and he repeats what the wise men said earlier. No wise men or enchanters or magicians or astrologers can show to the king what mystery the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in your bed are these. And Daniel describes this colossal statue with a head of gold and silver, bronze, and then iron. And then in verse 36, he begins the interpretation. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell the children of man and the beasts of the field and the birds of the heavens, making you ruler over them all, you are the head of gold. And what we learn is that every precious metal named here stands for another empire that will come after Nebuchadnezzar. And now we read Nebuchadnezzar's response in verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face, and he paid homage to Daniel. And he commanded an offering, an incense, be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. This is the word of the Lord. What I want us to do is just use Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar to contrast true wisdom and a false wisdom. So when the account opens up in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar's obviously on top of the world. He's personally successful as a world leader. His empire is second to none on the world stage, and even historians tell us today that Babylon is one of the most prestigious and powerful nations in world history. So he's personally successful, he's vocationally successful, and by all accounts, as one historian notes, he's a man of brilliance, of achievement, of vision, and generosity. And like King Midas of old, everything Nebuchadnezzar touches turns to gold. He's even the gold head in the image. So we're probably not expecting then the opening. Here's a highly successful man, safe behind the military might, safe behind the thick walls of Babylon, and he's troubled. This self-made ruler of the world had dreams, and his dreams made him troubled, and he couldn't sleep. Sometimes God comes after us in our suffering and loss. God could have humbled Nebuchadnezzar in losing some military battle, like the Battle of Carchemish in 605. But sometimes God comes after us by giving us success. Isn't that what happens to Nebuchadnezzar, mighty king of Babylon? We're told, as we just read, the God of heaven has given you might and power. The God of heaven has given you dominion over every part of the earth, beasts of the field, birds of the heaven. You rule over everything. Yet beneath it all, beneath all of his success, he's anxious and he's troubled. God doesn't come to Nebuchadnezzar in his suffering. He comes to him in his success. And while he sleeps, beneath it all, he's troubled. And God is behind it all. Isn't this a picture of some level of us? We strive, appropriately so, for success in our fields, a measure of comfort or approval from others in our lives, from our own work. We've all set our deepest hopes on something. It's just one more degree. It's just one more credential, one more invitation to speak or write, one more good grade, one more like or retweet of our post, one person who will love me. And we all think that to have that whatever it is will mean that we will have arrived at a kind of a level of stability, if not success in a measure. But what happens to people who've actually arrived? This story is telling us they're often anxious and troubled and insecure beneath the veneer of success. We're all this morning, at one level, a room of troubled people. And that trouble's kind of boiling and bubbling beneath our outward success. There's nothing more common than for highly successful people who are insecure. Nothing's more common than for highly successful people to be full of anxiety and turmoil deep down inside. And what does it tell us? Friends, I think it tells us that your wisdom and your power are not enough, and they never will be enough. I think the first thing we see, the big major thing, is that the wisdom of Babylon tells you that wisdom is self-contained, that we're self-sufficient, that we are all wise beings. But that gives to us, like it did to Nebuchadnezzar, a false sense of security. Because when he looked at the dream, whatever it meant, this big giant statue had a feet of clay. And deep down inside, he wondered if that's true about himself, his own work, his own life. Now, why is Nebuchadnezzar, think about this, why is Nebuchadnezzar, even though he's powerful and he's wise and he's successful, why is he troubled? He's troubled by the dream because the dream seems to be attacking his own dream. All of Nebuchadnezzar's hope, like any world ruler, lies in the fate of his empire. All of his identity lies in the success or failure of his work. And while he doesn't know the meaning of the dream at the front end, he does know there's a towering, colossal statue full of valuable and durable things like gold and silver and bronze and iron. But at the bottom, at the foundation, is clay. What's the most important part of any statue or building? Isn't it the foundation? And this foundation is weak. It's clay. It's brittle. And then, in this dream, something quite ordinary, not valuable like gold and silver, something ordinary, something as common as a rock, comes out of nowhere and it pulverizes the entire statue. And at some level, Nebuchadnezzar has to wonder, is this destruction talking about me in any way? And he's troubled. And he can't sleep because his entire sense of well-being is based in his wisdom and power. And this dream, even without interpretation, threatens his own dreams. It threatens everything he values. And we all set our hope on something to give us meaning and answers in life. For Nebuchadnezzar, it was his empire. It was his court of wise men. And the possibility that his dream might mean that his dream is telling him your dream might actually turn out to be a nightmare. And he loses sleep. The dream raises the dreaded possibility. I think it raises this kind of thing. What if I'm wrong? What does it mean? What if I'm wrong? It's just injecting questions and uncertainty into a man who seems to be certain. What if I'm wrong? And I think beneath it, in the dream, God is confronting the wisdom of Babylon and our wisdom today with two kinds of questions. How do you know what you know? And how do you know who you really are? These are the age-old questions of epistemology and identity. And in the dream, God is saying, Nebuchadnezzar, how do you know that you're right? How do you know your value system is correct? And Nebuchadnezzar, if you lose the empire, who are you then? How do you know? And who are you? And Nebuchadnezzar is deeply troubled. And he can't sleep. And when we face those questions, it does the same to us, or it should. Friend, what if your wisdom this morning is wrong? How do you know? And where does your sense of personhood come from? And what if that source of your personhood is wrong? How do you know it's right? Who are you? The wisdom of Babylon, you see, is telling you that true wisdom is self-contained. True wisdom is self-sufficient. We're self-made. We're self-knowing. But now, with this dream, all of it's being questioned. Is that really true? Is that where your value comes from? And what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He doubles down, in a sense. Nebuchadnezzar is worshiping kind of his own image. And he becomes like what he's worshiping. And when he's threatened, when his identity is threatened, when a source of wisdom is threatened, his true, broken, anxious self comes out. He becomes unreasonable, we see that, and he flies into a rage. Nebuchadnezzar asked the Chaldean wise men and the astrologers, tell me, I don't want you to tell me the meaning of the dream, tell me the dream that I had. This isn't because Nebuchadnezzar's forgotten his dream, but in a sense, the king knows how all of this works. I ask you as hired employees, privileged persons of the cabinet, and you're going to tell me what I want to hear. So I'm going to demand that you tell me what the dream is first, and that way I know that you're telling me the truth. Now, several times the story tells us that what Nebuchadnezzar asks is possible. And the entire narrative is set up and it comes to a focus before it fans out in verses 10 to 11. There's not a man on earth who can tell you what you're asking. Nobody has that kind of knowledge on the earth. Now, like many today, I mean, you can go to Barnes & Noble and find books on dream and they'll tell you if you dream this, here's what those dreams kind of mean. They had those books all the way back in the ancient imperial library of Babylon. Tell us what the dream, give us somewhere to start, O king. Everybody knows, even the modern reader knows that what Nebuchadnezzar is asking is far outside the realm of human knowledge. Maybe we don't know as much as we think we do after all. Maybe putting your faith in science isn't as sure as you think. And maybe you don't know either this morning. Aren't there things in life right now going on in your life that are beyond your understanding? Aren't there things in the world that the wisest scientists and philosophers of the world still can't figure out? And what should that tell you about yourself? What effect should it have on you? So Nebuchadnezzar shows that this view of a wisdom that's self-contained and self-sufficient actually makes him unreasonable and then irrationally angry. On one level, like any king in the day, he has absolute power. Some world rulers today as well. Nebuchadnezzar threatens to kill them all if they can't help him out. See, he's doubling down. I must know what I cannot know. I must know who I am and what this dream says. And instead of humbling him, it makes him anxious and unreasonable. And the story says very furious. One historian notes that Nebuchadnezzar is a man of extreme emotions and actions. At the end of the story, he's praising Daniel. But right now, he's full of anger and violence and tyranny. He's peremptory. He's malevolent. He's irascible. He's mistrustful. He's angry. He's violent. You see what's happened to him? Now, what's he really doing? What's going on? Why is he responding like this? Well, he's protecting his brand. He's fighting for his identity, for who he is. He can't dare to think that his wisdom, his power, his identity, which is where his value comes from, might come to an end. And he's anxious. And he's unreasonable. And he's angry. And his reactions reveal what he's really worshiping all the time. And that's how your reactions function too, and mine. They show us what we're worshiping, what really is controlling us. It shows us he's being threatened. And so he does something else. He grasps at power. Babylon says that your wisdom is self-contained and self-sufficient. And Babylon also says that your power is to be grasped. You must have power. And once you have it, you wield it like a sword, especially when your dream and your empire and your identity is threatened. Now, do you see what the first half of this story is telling us? That one source of wisdom, the wisdom of Nebuchadnezzar, actually comes from and produces pride and unrest and the abuse of power. All three of those things are true of Nebuchadnezzar. And this is such a common way, you know, an accepted way to find meaning and self-worth is to see wisdom as ultimate. Wisdom is the self-contained apparatus that you go after. Wisdom is self-sufficient. And it's also true that you see power then, authority. You have to go after it. You have to have it. And once you have it, you wield it like a sword to build your own empire and to protect it. Because his identity is in his work and his success. And so, what we're about to see, or what I hope we're seeing already, is that this story is showing us that there are actually false sources of wisdom and identity and power. They look good. Don't you see that the passage reveals there are certain forms of wisdom and power that look reliable? They look certain. But at the bottom, they actually have feet of clay. Nebuchadnezzar and all of his wise men ran out of wisdom. No one can do this, they ran around saying. And it's saying that to us today. You're not wise enough to navigate life, especially on your own. Human wisdom is limited. Not even science and all of its boasting has all the answers. And your identity comes from the wrong thing, and you're using your power and your influence most often for yourself. Now, Daniel tells us the opposite story. We'll come back to the theme of power in a big way next week, but Daniel shows us now that the wisdom of God is the only true wisdom. And that by embracing the wisdom of God, it leads to humility and an active rest and the use of power for the good of other people. Nebuchadnezzar's proud and arrogant and angry, but Daniel, even in his responses, comes across as humble and gracious. And the striking thing, of course, is that Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar not only foils one against the other, but Daniel's disadvantaged in every way. He's a youth. Nebuchadnezzar's in the prime of adulthood. He's a Jewish POW in a foreign land. Nebuchadnezzar's on his home turf, surrounded by all the power and wisdom that he can have. But when Nebuchadnezzar's confronted that his wisdom might be at an end, he doubles down, he's angry and he's anxious. But when Daniel's wisdom is confused and he's disillusioned by the exile and where God is, Daniel is humbled by a God who must be wiser than himself. The greatest indication in this text and elsewhere in the book of Daniel that Daniel is humbled beneath the wisdom of God is that Daniel's life is characterized again and again by prayer. And what a marvelous prayer it is. Everything that Nebuchadnezzar claims that he is or he wants, God really is. Nebuchadnezzar's after wisdom and might. Blessed are you, O God, who's full of wisdom and power. Nebuchadnezzar wants to know the times and the seasons. He wants to know the unknown. But Daniel acknowledges, God, you know the times and the seasons, and you know what's in the dark. Daniel's prayer shows us that an idol is anything in your life that you're giving the attributes of God to. That's what Nebuchadnezzar's done. You know, so for some, science is your God because you expect it to give you ultimate answers to life, to important questions, and you say power and might belong to science. Other people are controlled by their feelings and desires, their impulses. And you say, power and might and honor and majesty belongs to my feelings and desires. But Daniel says, only God, and God alone is full of power and might and wisdom. And Daniel shows us that true wisdom makes us humble before God. The mysteries of life make Nebuchadnezzar proud. The mysteries of life make Daniel humble. Wise people are humble. And embracing the wisdom of God is what produces this humility. Because Daniel knows, in contrast to the view of wisdom in Babylon, Daniel knows that wisdom is not self-contained, but wisdom has to be revealed. And the whole story hinges that only God can reveal the most important things in life. Wisdom is revealed. Not self-contained. And in embracing the wisdom of God, we see Daniel's rest. In contrast to Nebuchadnezzar's anxiety, his insecurity, his anger, this is not to say Daniel's heart rate doesn't go up when he hears that you're about to be killed. But Daniel's identity is in God alone, the God who controls history, the God who controls empires, the God of mercy. Daniel tells his friends, go seek the God of mercy. Thus, Daniel finds his hope not in his work. Daniel finds his hope in God's work for him. God is a God of mercy. Go seek his mercy. That was his identity. Daniel knew that wisdom is revealed, and Daniel knew that identity is something given to us by God, and grounded in the character of God, and grounded in the work of God. Now, as Christians, then think how comforting and activity-producing that is in us. As Christians, our value comes from the fact that we've been given an identity. We're made in the image of God. And your identity is given, and therefore you can't go out and find it, nor can you go out and lose it. And so our life as Christians is a stubborn refusal to let nothing other than God's love define us. And as we look at each other this morning, those members in our church that you find hard to put up with, or neighbors that are difficult, you won't let them be defined by anything else either than the love of God, made in the image of God. Daniel knows that wisdom is revealed. He's at rest because his identity is in the God of mercy, the God in control. And then we see Daniel that he knows that by the way God uses his power, he knows that power isn't something to be grasped, but power is actually given. It's delegated. Nebuchadnezzar, who made you king? God has given this to you. God gives power. All power is given and given not to be wielded like a sword, but to be used like a surgeon's scalpel to heal and restore, or to fracture, but only to bind back together again. And the only place, I think, in the history of the world you see power being, absolute power being used like that, is when the Son of God is nailed to the cross. We see that Daniel's notion of power is transformed because in the middle of the appeal, he's not only appealing for his own life, But the phrase is, he's appealing not only that his life be spared, he wants all of the other court magicians to be spared too. He is seeking their welfare. He loves those who... Nebuchadnezzar wants to use his power to put down and kill those who won't comply. Daniel wants to use his power to serve and protect even those he disagrees with. He knows that power, as he sees it in God, is given for the good of others. Now, because God gives power, all that means at one level is that you are not bigger than God today. God gives and he takes. He is in control and he's sovereign over your life. And at one level, like it troubled Nebuchadnezzar, it should trouble you if you don't know him. God is bigger than you are. And you will give an account to him. But if you do know him, think of the comfort it is to know that God is bigger than you are. And he's not big and therefore he's going to bully you, but he's bigger than your sin, any part of it. And don't you dare let yourself be defined then by your struggle with sin, by your struggle with unbelief. You are adopted. You're sanctified. You're justified. You're chosen. You're a holy one. You're redeemed. You're in Christ. You're loved. You are mine. That's how he uses his power. The power of his love is greater than the power of our unbelief. And Daniel's showing us that true wisdom is revealed, and that it shows us that identity and power are given, not grasped at. And that leads to humility. And when we humble ourselves before God's wisdom and God's power, it's then we become who we really are, who we've been, who we're meant to be. Now, when the story ends, you say, how do you respond to this? Well, the story tells us. On one level, we're to respond like Nebuchadnezzar did. At the end of the passage, here's the irony. The king of Babylon is face down before a Jewish teenage exile. And one day it will be so that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. But you need to do more than what Nebuchadnezzar's doing. Nebuchadnezzar's a religious response, but it's not a saving response. At one level, Nebuchadnezzar is just adding the God of the Bible to the list of all his other gods. I've got room for one more. Come on in and join me. But this passage is calling us for a deeper humility than that. It's humility shown by Daniel himself. Daniel truly humbles himself before the God of mercy because Daniel knows he needs mercy. And everyone around him needs mercy. The passage calls us to humble ourselves, to embrace the wisdom of God, the only wisdom that can make you humble, the only wisdom that can make you love people who differ from you. And it's telling us in the ancient Jewish proverb, trust in the Lord with all your heart and don't lean on your own understanding. With all your heart. Embracing the wisdom of God is a demand for humility and it leads to rest and wisdom in the use of your life, your power, your gifts, your influences for other people. And where then do we see here at the end, where do we see the wisdom of God? Where do we see the mercy of God? Well, Daniel's part of a broader story in the Bible, isn't it? Jesus Christ is the wisdom and the mercy of God. At the cross, we see God's wisdom revealed to us, a wisdom that like using a teenage Jewish exile named Daniel in Babylon, a wisdom that looks foolish and unlikely. Yet Jesus on the cross is the wisdom of God. You see, Jesus is the rock in this vision. He's the ordinary, overlooked, discarded rock who who pulverizes the kingdoms and imaginations of the world as he rules and reigns from the cross. And at the cross, God is, he's throwing down a challenge. Don't miss it. At the cross, God is shaming the wisdom of the wise, just like he did with Nebuchadnezzar. He who thinks himself as wise must become a fool, he says. And at the cross, we see Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the one who has all authority in heaven and earth, the one who has all of his authority. Here's the Son of God using his power, not for himself, but he uses his power to save us. He gives up his power to save us from our sins against him, to save us against our sins from one another, to save us from the destructive impulses that dehumanizes us as human beings made in the image of God. He uses his power to save us. He gives it all up. He's come to set us free from our sins. He's come to set us free from our past. He's come to give us the hope of glory, to make us fully human as we're renewed in the knowledge and righteousness of the Creator and Redeemer. You see, the gospel of God is Jesus Christ transforming all earthly notions of wisdom and power and identity, and he turns them inside out. I was reminded late last night of an old song by Michael Card called God's Own Fool. He sings, I'll read. When we in our foolishness thought we were wise, he played the fool and he opened our eyes. When we in our weakness believed we were strong, he became helpless to show we were wrong. And so we follow God's own fool, for only the foolish can tell. Believe the unbelievable, come be a fool as well. So come lose your life for a carpenter's son, for a madman who died for a dream, and you'll have the faith his first followers had, and you'll feel the weight of the beam. So surrender the hunger to say you must know. Have the courage to say, I believe. For the power of paradox opens your eyes and blinds those who say they can see. And so we follow God's own fool. Believe the unbelievable. Come be a fool as well. Well, how does that happen? What does it mean to really humble yourself? Well, I think it means it's not pretty. It's not sentimental. It's not Hallmark movie type stuff. You'll have to let him crush your life. He's the rock that smashes everything about you in pieces. You cannot come halfway with him. You come to an old rugged cross where you humble yourself with all of your brokenness and your guilt beneath his holiness. Come to the cross where all of your wisdom will be stripped away. Come to the cross where your identity will be smashed to pieces, where your power is shattered. And at the moment of death to self, the moment when the lights go out, you hear the one whose name is love say, today you will be with me in paradise. This is what the humble king demands. Trust in the Lord Jesus Christ alone with all your heart, and lean not into your own understanding. And you'll be a new creation. Old things passed away. All things become new. And you'll find the steadfast love of the Lord is better than life.